Okay, so why do we need good dynamical models? How do we make them now? And I want to introduce, just remind you or introduce to you, quasi-periodicity and integrability, and because that feeds into what I believe is the future of modeling for the Milky Way. And I may say a little bit about what you can do with this, and but that depends on time. Okay. So why do we need dynamical models? Basically because dynamical models connect measurements. We see the galaxy, we can count stars, we can measure velocities in a whole load of different places, and dynamics links those, makes very strong predictions about connecting what you see in one place to what you see in another place, because the stars that you see here, will have friends on the same orbit, which will also be over here, and if you don't understand about the dynamics, you can relate these things. So it also connects velocity space to real space. If you, most naively, like something like the order limit, you measure the velocities in the plane at z equals naught, and then that tells you, if you understand about dynamics, that connects that to the density structure that you expect to see as you go above z equals naught. Conversely, if you know about the density structure as you go above z equals naught, and you know about dynamics, you can say what velocity you have to measure at z equals naught. It connects stars to dark matter. Dark matter can't be seen. I mean, hasn't been seen, and it isn't going to be. It certainly isn't going to be mapped around the galaxy in a very I guess indirect detection might do something for you. But you really want to map it around the galaxy by looking at its gravitational field, in addition to any annihilation. Even if you see any annihilation, which you're not guaranteed to do. And so, insofar as we're in an era when you can only detect dark matter from its gravitational field, then you need to use dynamics to connect the motions of stars to the underlying gravitational field. And finally, dynamics reduces the dimensionality of the galaxy from 6, because fundamentally it's an object that exists it's a much bigger dimension than 6, but at least 6, because any particular type of star has a distribution in a 6-dimensional phase space. If you understand about dynamics, you can reduce that to a 3-dimensional, or you may be able to provisionally reduce that to a 3-dimensional phase space of conserved quantities. And so that's another, that reduction in dimensionality is enormously important. Okay, why do we need upgrade now? I think that's very self-evident. There have been these fantastic technical developments, which are partly in the past and partly in the future, so that this wall of data of tremendous quantity and precision and beauty is hitting us, and our dynamical methods are essentially stuck, very largely stuck in the 1970s, is a polite way of putting it. So there is need to raise their game to be equal to this, to take advantage of this tremendous data obtained very expensively. So what do you, if you sit down and think to yourself, so what do I need for a modeling instrument, what would your science requirement be? Well, the Milky Way is a very complicated system. It's got a bulge in a bar, spiral arms, streams, it's got a star formation rate, which depends on metallicity, alpha, you know, chemical composition in two parameters, and time, at many different, all kinds of different locations. Very important processes include secular heating, radial migration, chemical evolution, and so on. We don't really want a definitive model. You don't want to dive straight to a definitive model of this enormously complicated animal. We're not going to get understanding of these very complicated data sets if we don't proceed in some kind of an orderly way, getting the gross structure right, and then finding out which things still are anomalous in the data, and interpreting those in terms of refinements, and proceeding in some orderly manner. So we want models which are idealizations, but we want, as we proceed, to refine these idealizations as much as we have patience and energy and data to follow. So I think we have to proceed hierarchically, for example, starting with axisymmetric models, then adding the bar, then adding spiral structure, then adding the warp, then adding metallicity tagging, and so on. I think this layering is going to be an essential process of obtaining understanding of the rich data. I also think that we need to know what the distribution function is for each class of star. So in other words, we need a natural number for the phase space density so that we can sample at will. Let's say we can draw a Monte Carlo sample to see to see a discrete realization with whatever density that we want in order to deal with the refinements, and also so that we can calculate the likelihoods of models, or the likelihood of data given models, to decide whether models are making progress or good or bad. And I think we must be able to model secular evolution, so that's the slow evolution of the distribution function as a result of things like scattering or scattering by whatever sources, and that's going to be possible if we know what the distribution function is, and it's going to be hard if you don't know what the distribution function is. So, yes? Yeah, okay, well, at some level I would say the ideal model, what I would like to have, would be a set of distribution functions for stars of every particular type. And of course, a matching consistent potential which would obviously include a model for the dark matter distribution, which itself, but I think the dark matter is just another stellar type. It has to have a distribution function and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, it's not one that you get to observe directly, but it's part of the model. So I think I would say a model is a set of distribution functions and, of course, a procedure for determining what the self-consistent potential is from all of that. And of course, temporal evolution, you'd have a model of which, you, in the sense that these distribution functions would evolve according to certain equations in understood ways. Okay, so how do we do it now? There are two popular procedures. One is n-body modeling, been enormously important because it's operationally straightforward. What are its limitations? There has traditionally been a serious lack of control of configuration. You set the model up with some initial conditions, you let it go, things happen, it settles down to something or other, you're not really in control. Now, there's been an enormous advance, I think, in that respect, with a Siren-Tremaine made-to-measure proposal having been made a working, a going concern by Orbin Gerhardt and his collaborators. So to some extent, that's I would say, not a major objection at this time. What I would say is a major objection is it's very hard to characterize the configuration. An n-body model doesn't tell you what its distribution function is. It's a set of stars which sample a distribution function whose value you don't know. That leads to difficulties of communication. How do we characterize the differences between my n-body model and your n-body model? It's hard to do. Poisson noise is always a problem with n-body models. You cannot have too many stars. It doesn't matter how big your computer, you never have as many points as you want to have. And coming with the noise, which is a statistical problem, there's also spurious relaxation within the model, which may or may not be an issue, but the noise certainly is an issue. There's a sampling problem, which was pointed out by Brown and Aguilar a few years ago, and I don't think we're seriously enough focused on, and that's this, that in the Milky Way, we're sitting in the Milky Way, we have a part of it right in front of our noses, we can see right down the luminosity function to very faint objects, brown dwarfs, blah, 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 which must be all over the galaxy as well. So they need to be in the model. On the other hand, if you put them in your n-body model, you will see only 0.00001% or something of the brown of your particles, because they're only the ones that are right in front of your nose can you see. So you can't afford just to put them in the n-body model. Then how do you do the modeling, taking account of the fact that there are very faint objects, very low luminosity objects that you see only very close by, but they do feature in the catalog, and then in the background, but then there are more luminous objects which you can trace all around the galaxy. So there is a serious sampling problem associated with n-body models of the Milky Way. It's not a problem that arises when you do models of other galaxies, where all stars are essentially at the same distance. And it's hard, I think, in an n-body model to add stellar populations, secular and chemical evolution, to bear in mind that there are, in fact, a zillion different types of stars with different metallicity and different dates of birth, and they will all have their own distribution function, and we need to. It's crucial to carry information about that. It's very difficult to get that level of layering with an n-body model. Schwarzschild modeling has been the standard way, for example, for searching for black holes in the centers of other galaxies. Just to remind you what the game is, we choose a potential, we choose some observables, and then we integrate orbits in a guess at the potential, and we save the fraction of the time that the alpha star spends at certain phase-space locations, and then you seek these weights to associate with the alpha orbit, so that you generate your observables. Here I'm just imagining that I knew what the density was as my observable, which was the original Schwarzschild proposal, but it's been upgraded from that to any observable. The limitations of this procedure are, well, it's messy. You need to store m phase-space points. That means nm has obviously got to be a large number. You need weights, you need probabilities to find an orbit in m locations in phase space for n orbits, which means you're looking at n times m matrix, which gets to be very big because you want n orbits to be thousands and thousands and thousands, and you need m to be thousands and thousands and thousands. Another problem is the orbits are not naturally characterized. We're back to the inability to explain to other people how your model differs from their model, because they had some initial conditions, you got some initial conditions. The initial conditions are not themselves of particular interest, but that's all we've got to characterize the orbits. We still have a Poisson noise problem. We have the problem that we have to set up these equations in such a way that they're underdetermined, which means there's no unique solution, and the proper procedure in these circumstances is to, for example, if you want to know what the right potential is to find the potential which allows the largest possible number of solutions, but this is computationally so expensive that nobody has done it. And we still haven't solved the sampling problem, the problem of the low luminosity stars and the bright stars. So what I want to try and sell you on now is an upgrade fundamentally to this method based on replacing orbits as time series with orbital tori. So it's in some sense, and it's in a real sense an extension. So suppose we have a Hamiltonian. So we have a Hamiltonian for the galaxy. This is just the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. Supposing you, and in the concrete example, let's take the famous logarithmic potential and integrate some orbits. You find, this is a well-known fact, that orbits come in two in various families. But so here we are. Here are some box orbits, and here are some loop orbits. And the crucial thing is that if you look at the time series and Fourier decompose them, you find that the time series consists of just lines, and not continua. So these things can be represented by a finite, by an infinite number really, but a discrete set of sinusoidal variations. This is just a couple of these. Of the coordinates, coordinates down orbits like this, Fourier transforms. So these orbits are quasi-periodic, and that means, so whenever you see that in a numerical calculation, it means that that magic integrals exist, J1, J2, and J3, that can be complemented by coordinates to get a set of six coordinates for phase space in a consistent way. And the equations of motion of these magic coordinates are trivial. They say that the constants of motion are constant, and that the angle variables, the complementary variables, increase linearly in time. And it's because these variables increase linearly in time that you see these line-like spectra when you Fourier decompose the time series you obtain by integrating an orbit. So the orbits are, in fact, three tori. What's a three torus? It's just a cube with opposite faces identified. It's conceptually simple object. The orbits are actually three tori, and they're labeled by the actions, the three numbers that are constant, and the angle variables theta tell you where you are on the torus. They're sort of like x, y, and z in your room, telling you how far you are. X and Y on the floor, and Z how high up you are in this room. The only thing is it's a room with the floor and the ceiling identified and the opposite walls identified. Now, the little technical detail, these tori have a special geometrical property in phase space. They're null in the sense that if you do the integral dx dv, this is a dot product, on this thing, it always comes to zero. They have vanishing Poincaré invariant, which is an important technical detail. So the question is, how do we find x and v? What we need to know is a way of finding x and v given j and theta. So you want to find the ordinary boring phase-space coordinates given J, which tells you which orbit you're on, and theta, where you are on that orbit. Okay, so there are some analytic solutions to this problem, and this is important. This is where one can start out. The most general potential for which this can be done, you can analytically solve this problem, was already identified by Schlegel in the 19th century. These potentials are separable. The technical details here that are not very important. What is important is that there are some analytical solutions, and there are two really important examples. There are ones where the potential is simply separable in X, Y, and Z, or spherically symmetric. These are special cases of Schlegel potentials and easy to work with. Our group has done work very much with this isochrone potential, so it's a trivial spherical potential, a very simple spherical potential for which everything is exceptionally easily worked out. So what's the idea? The idea is that you take a toy torus belonging to this analytical model where you know everything analytically, and you map this thing into your real phase space numerically. And you adjust this mapping until the energy is constant all over the image torus. And it turns out that's all you have to do. If you can get this torus mapped in and get the energy constant, it's obviously necessary that the energy is constant on the image, or else it obviously isn't an orbit. But if it is, then that's all you need to do, and you're home. You have an orbit. Here's an example of how to do it. This is a diagram that you may have seen before, which is meant to persuade you that these numerically integrated orbits in a certain logarithmic potential, but another potential will give you similar patterns, bar potential, actually have boundaries which are very nearly parallel to surfaces of constant, either ellipses or hyperbole. So what does that tell you? It tells you that here are U and V are these elliptical coordinates, and when U and V cover a rectangle, this would be a rectangle in UV space, then X and Y cover a realistic box orbit, or almost. So what do you do next? So what you say is, well, let's drive U and V. Let's drive U and V over this rectangle by having X, which is some function of U, and Y, which is some function of V, execute simple harmonic motion. If X and Y are executing simple harmonic motion, they'll fill a Lissajous figure. They'll fill a rectangle in X and Y, and then U and V will be filling a rectangle as well, and there you are. And this is all easily done. We can easily get X and Y to execute simple harmonic motion because I know what the relation is between X and JX, the action associated with this magic integral associated with simple harmonic oscillator, and theta X, the magic angle variable associated with simple harmonic oscillator. So what do? I say J and theta, which are this thing and this thing, there are two J's and one, you know, for X and Y each has a J, then I've got this analytical formulae here which take me from there to X and PX, etc., Y and PY. I have these formulae which take me to U and PU, V and PV, which then through this take me to my space over the page. So I've generated, the idea behind this is that this series of operations enables you to obtain something that looks like this, or something that looks like this, out of a simple harmonic oscillator. Okay, but the trouble is it's not sufficiently general, because this series of operations requires that the orbit is exactly bounded by ellipses and hyperbole, and it isn't exactly bounded by ellipses and hyperbole. It's just a good approximation. So no problem. All you do is you front up the very first transformation. You make J and theta, these are the angle and action variables of our harmonic oscillator. You make these the images of a mapping here, canonical mapping here to here, which is almost the identity mapping. So this is a generating function of a canonical transformation. This bit would generate the identity transformation that would make these equal to these. And then we add in some Fourier series here, which moderates that. And the name of the game is you choose these SNs, you get your computer to choose these SNs in such a way that we have a we obtain an orbital torus. So there's and now we have a general mapping from a toy space into my real space. Sorry?
How many N's do you need?
Well, maybe 100 or something. It's a question of how fiddly you are, how what precision you want to operate with, okay? So basically what the torus program consists of, think of it as a replacement for your Runge-Kutta integrator. With your Runge-Kutta integrator, you get your machine to do a series of operations and it spits out a time sequence. It gives you the phase-space coordinates as a function of time. Here, you set up your computer, you say what kind of orbit you want to find, you specify the actions of this orbit, it grumbles away, it spits out the characteristic what coordinate system we ought to use for these ellipsoidal coordinates and a few things of that nature, and it spits out a load of these, maybe 100 of these coefficients here, and those characterize your orbit, and once you've got that, you've got something that's much better than the time series. Okay, here's just a little numerical example of how to do this. Here are some orbits in a Steckel potential. This just goes to show that you can reconstruct the Steckel potential. You know, it is exactly integrable. It has precisely these orbital tori, and you can't see that there are dots and lines here. They're completely overlaid because the computer's done a perfect job. If you take a logarithmic potential, you don't get a perfect job because it's not an integrable potential. But you can get a job which is as good as you want it to be. I mean, you can refine it until you
James, what was the N for that?
About 60. This is all very ancient work, and it's...
If you want to get convergence
to sort this here?
Yeah.
I don't think I can answer that properly, but I don't think you need a huge number. It's not a... Okay, so and you don't need to proceed through harmonic oscillators. You can proceed through isochrones. These are details. I don't think it's useful to. I've told you what you need to know. This is just showing that you can do the same thing. You can do the same thing in the meridional plane, right? I mean, choose whatever orbits you want. There's a way you can do this. Okay. And we have actually only done this for axisymmetric potentials and for two-dimensional barred potentials, but there is no reason. I mean, it's just a matter of nothing to stop you from upgrading this to three-dimensional potentials. We just don't happen to have three-dimensional barred potentials. We just don't happen to have done it. Okay. So this is what's more important. What have we achieved? We've got analytical formulae. I mean, we've got these numbers. Of course, your computer's going to have to work out these formulae, but they're analytical formulae which give you what x and v are, the useful coordinates in terms of actions and angles. So what's crucial is you can now find at what value of theta a star will pass through a particular point. So let's go back, to this picture here. So if you're patient, you choose a place here, eventually the star will come through that place, and it'll come through that place with one of four velocities. And with this if you are a Schwarzschild person, you have to just look all through your whole stupid time sequence. Where can I find a place where it came close to here, right? If you are doing this with tori, it's not a problem. You just solve for the thetas at which it will come through, and bingo, you're all done. You don't have to go looking through some horrific list. You just find what velocity it will come through when it comes through. So that's a very important plus. Okay, I've made this point that if you just do orbit integration, it'll come close, but it'll never actually get there, and you've got to find the closest, and you never know where that is in the time sequence. The orbit is characterized by these actions, and unlike initial conditions, actions are essentially unique. There's some sort of discrete transformations between one set of actions and another set of actions, but we can easily agree with our friends which actions we're using, and if they're using a different system, they just tell me which system, and I can convert their actions into my actions. So we can all know which we can compare our orbits. Even if we're using different potentials, we can compare our orbits. So we have a common language to discuss our models with. The sampling density is absolutely apparent, therefore the phase-space density is apparent because I have this beautiful relationship here. A piece of phase-space volume, of six-dimensional phase-space volume, is just 2 pi cubed times a three-dimensional piece of my orbit, my integral space. So if you use actions for coordinates of integral space is a fair and exact representation of the real world, of the real phase space. These actions are adiabatic invariants, so as I accrete matter and my potential slowly evolves, my orbits stay fixed in orbit space, they just change in real space. And this helps me to deal with a load of problems like mass loss, two-body relaxation, disk accretion, etc. There's a natural relationship between the real space characteristics of orbits and their values of the actions. This is described a little bit in galactic dynamics, so that you can design a distribution function which will give you a component which has a particular shape. When you write down the distribution function, if you did this with energy and angular momentum, you'd never be able to figure out what exactly you were going to get. If you do it with actions, you can figure out what you're going to get broadly before you sit down and tell the computer to give you a detailed computation. Numerically integrated orbits have to be characterized. So you can characterize your orbits by explaining what the parameters are in these coordinate transformations I was talking about, plus 100 or so of these SNs, and this has to compare with thousands of phase-space points if you integrate it in time. So it's much more compact representation of what an orbit is. These SNs are continuous functions of the Js, so that you can, when you've got a grid of orbits in action space, you can interpolate and construct other orbits by just straightforward interpolation. You can calculate the likelihood of arbitrary data. You can calculate the likelihood of a catalog like Gaia or any other catalog, no matter what you've measured, any phase-space information, not necessarily a complete set of numbers. You can calculate the likelihood of a model in terms of these data in terms of a model simply by doing a one-dimensional integral for each star, taking full account of the observational errors. And if you know what the distribution function is, once you've chosen your distribution function as a function of J, there's a stable scheme for constructing the self-consistent potential. The Fokker-Planck equation is exceptionally simple when written in angle action coordinates, which is important from the point of view of calculating secular evolution. And we can also do Hamiltonian perturbation theory, which I suspect will be the key to handling things like spiral structure. Okay. Well, I was just going to illustrate a little bit about... So resonant trapping is an important process. So this is the kind of... So I'm now talking about... I've spoken about the gross structure of a galaxy model, and now you might worry about the refinements that you'll have to put in, like, for example, that spiral structure perturbs the velocity space near the sun. If we had a gross model, the surfaces of constant star density would be sort of ellipses, broadly speaking, in this space. And in fact, there are all these wiggles and wobbles. There's a consensus that this is a result of resonant trapping. Okay, thank you. And this, I think, is what you will handle by. This is the sort of thing which is best handled by doing perturbation theory on your basic model. You don't have to do it that way, but I think it's and this is just a perturbation theory really works when you work with these orbital tori. Classical perturbation theory doesn't have a very good reputation for working well, and that's because people do classical perturbation to do perturbation Hamiltonian perturbation theory. You have to have angle action coordinates. So how do people do this? They do it using the angle action coordinates of the Kepler potential or some other spherical potential. And these are not good starting points because perturbation theory depends on what your orbital frequencies are. And when you're in a spherical potential, two of your frequencies coincide. When you're in a Kepler potential, all three of your frequencies coincide, and it makes it an awkward starting point. So here is an example that Kasalainen did in 94. His thesis. This is by direct integration some resonant box orbit, and this is where he gets with the underlying torus and perturbation theory. So he's calculated the orbit trapping by resonant perturbation theory, and you can't tell the difference, can you? here is the relevant surface of the section belonging to that. The dots are the numerically integrated consequence, and the curves are what you get by this perturbation theory. You can't do that in the standard way. Here is a more rigorous example. Here's a dirty great resonant region here. This is a banana orbit this is the surface of section. This is a banana orbit in a box-like potential. And here are the toruses that have been pushed through this non-integrable potential. So here are three toruses that have been pushed through. And then this is what you get when you do perturbation theory on that. You can also directly calculate these. You can also calculate these banana orbits by making toruses that are banana-like, right? So you have a choice. You can, with a dirty great resonance, you can either construct your toruses to be banana-like, and then you get a perfect fit, or you can construct your toruses to be box-like, and then obtain the bananas as resonant trapping of the boxes. Okay, so this is. Just a few words about Paul McMillan's poster outside, where he already spoke a little bit about yesterday, where some satellite was allowed to be tidally torn apart, sort of an attempt at a model of the Arcturus group. And so now it's at 7.5 giga, it's sort of totally phase mixed. You can't see, it doesn't look as if you can see, you can get this lot to go back to that, but you can if you use the right angle action coordinates. This is the action space showing the grouping in action space, which is the signal that these things all came from a single orbit. This is an important diagram that I think Paul didn't show, which is showing that out of the frequencies which you calculate and the angle variables that you calculate for each star, so each star gets to have orbital frequencies found by the torus machinery, each star gets to have angle variables found by the torus machinery, and out of these you can construct these diagnostics, these delta thingies. You add them up over all the stars and you get a delta bar thing here, these things depend on time. As you vary the time, this thing wiggles around. This is obviously an interference pattern. Anybody can see that. And when the interferences, when the amplitude of these fluctuations become large, that's when you have followed the stars in some sense back to their original position, and they're all in about the same position. That's the moment when the thing was tidally disrupted. So this was an n-body simulation, so this is actually when it was tidally disrupted, and this is showing that you can recover that, because where these oscillations are largest, is you can recover that out of the angle variables. So there are lots of games that you can play here. So here are my conclusions. I think existing analytic and particle-based methods are simply not going to be adequate for what we need to do with existing and future surveys. Particle models are seriously limited by Poisson noise, poor characterization of orbits, and there's this sampling problem. We need the distribution function is really the key thing there, and you don't get that out of a particle-based model. These difficulties are eliminated if, in the Schwarzschild method, you replace time series with orbital tori. Orbital tori allow you to use perturbation to do perturbation theory in a systematic and powerful way, which helps you to develop a deeper understanding of what's really happening in the galaxy. Physics has historically been enormously based. Just think of Feynman diagrams or resonant trapping in the solar system. Our picture of what happens in the world has often been structured by perturbation theory, and I think it'll be very valuable to have the tools to use perturbation theory on the galaxy. You can identify tiny destroyed clusters and even determine the date of the disruption using this technology, and you can what we will have to do is characterize populations by their each population having a sort of analytic distribution function which evolves slowly in time to reflect secular heating. So I guess that is that. Thank you.
Okay, so you had your hand first.
I can see where you're going with this, and it looks fantastically powerful, especially your motivation for in the time domain, in terms of the events past. So my question to you would be, if in an era of Gaia, where you have a billion stars zipping around, there must be things like, as you've already shown in other papers, diffusion and scattering and horrible things going on. So are you imagining that this is not so much in the plane or near the plane, but things which are streamy things moving away from the plane, where you might may be able to reconstruct past history?
Yeah. Yes, I don't see why we shouldn't be able to reconstruct past history of things that are away from the plane.
But can you visualize how far down into the sort of thick disk this approach may be of use to you?
It obviously depends on the degree of random scattering. I mean, unfolding many scattering events is going to be hard, clearly. And I don't think I know what the answer to that question is. I think if you've tried it, you know, suck it and see. So the next step, which you know we're trying to do at this very moment, is to take the rave data and find angles and actions for everybody and look for structures.
James, this over here. Your machinery looks terribly impressive. Have you done an application that will also, is there reason to wait for Gaia to apply this? It seems that
the data sets are... Oh, absolutely not. No.
What are your plans?
Sorry, what are our plans? Well, we're taking the internal data release of 200 and something thousand rave stars, and that's what we're doing at the moment, and doing this stuff to look for structure in it. We should then move forward to, something that's supposed to be happening in parallel, roughly, is to look at we need models of the thin disk, thick disk, of the disk, which includes thin and thick, because I don't believe in dividing the two, except, of course, insofar as we have to have a distribution function for high alpha and low alpha stars at the very minimum. So we need some basic models in an axisymmetric context of that. And we should be able to apply that to both RAVE and simultaneously apply that to RAVE and the SDSS, the Urich et al., etc. analysis. So those are our next targets.
So I have a related question to Joss. It's but really in the time domain. Mm-hmm. So you take Gaia, how far back in time, if given that early in the universe we would expect more major accretion events, you wouldn't be able to, how far back do you think you could go?
I don't know, and it's not top of my, it isn't top of my agenda in the sense that what I think we have to do first is obtain a representation of the galaxy as we see it now. Having got that, you're in, and of course you go through the search, if you've got real data, you go through the issue of searching for suspicious groupings of objects in frequencies and so on. So of course we will do that, but there are many reasons why I wouldn't find those things, in particular the measurement errors. I mean, I think I feel a very big sales point here is what I said about you can calculate the likelihood when there are enormous. So if some coordinate hasn't even been measured, So in any parallax survey, you will always have a great majority of stars that have appalling parallaxes. But even a bad parallax is information. It tells you it's not a big parallax. So it's important that you have this kind of machinery that you can assess the likelihoods of models. And therefore, my orientation is on finding these distribution functions and doing what I can with the distribution functions. I regard the actual stars to a large extent as dross. There's something which I want to use up and to find that to constrain the distribution function, then throw away. There will be other people who will be interested in those stars, but I'm worried that the experimental errors in the individual stars will stop you doing many of the things you'd like to do.
So relative to the biography of Hamilton, what is responsible for the late development of this method? Is it essentially that it's computationally difficult to do the mapping and requires computers, or just lack of neurons working on it, or what?
Well, it's both of these things. So this should have, I would have said this should have been done, say, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. It couldn't have been done much before that because you do need some CPU cycles. It's a bit more expensive than a Runge cutter. It's not enormously more expensive than a Runge cutter. And the other thing is that you've got to have strong prejudices. This is a technique for prejudiced bastards, right, who know what the bloody orbits should be doing, and I don't want any back chat about what you are doing, right? I don't want to hear all about your stupid little resonances and your this and that. I know that the right way to understand you is as some loop orbit or some box orbit. And when I've forced you into this mold and understood what the basic structure is, then I'm willing to listen in next order to some stuff about being resonant or something, right? So if you are trying to calculate, if you just want to know what an orbit is from an initial condition, it's not the method for you. If you want to impose order on a great mass of data, then it's the method for you. Now, I'm not sure to what extent that's been the case before, right? If you're interested in planets, you're interested in orbits. If you're interested in asteroids, you might be interested in this.
Well, that was actually another question. Is, you know, so you railed against the Kepler problem, but is this useful for, you know, things that genuinely start off as Kepler potentials, or is that already subsumed in a previous version?
If your unperturbed system is a Kepler system, you don't need this. You've got angle action coordinates. Get on with it. If your system is not a Kepler system, then please don't try and reach it by perturbing a Kepler system.
Yeah, I just have a comment and a question. I mean, as you know, the stuff I talked about on Tuesday was basically taking this machinery and moving forward, assuming that I know a distribution and I could perturb the thing, see what happens as the tori move forward in time. One of the things always worried me about this, I mean, it works very nicely, but one of the things always worried me about this is that there's an implicit assumption of the averaging theorem, right, that you can, in fact, replace your time integration with the phase integration. And mm-hmm. Solar circle and outwards, or some point in outwards, that's becoming a worse approximation. So do you have any feeling for, I don't know, the limitations in this inverse problem, essentially, that you're trying to do?
Well, since I'm not, I think the question you should be asking, Martin, is how confident am I that I can adequately characterize the galaxy by a distribution in integral space, which is tantamount to saying the distribution is uniform all over the torus.
Yeah, that's the question.
The answer, of course, has to be that I agree completely that at a sufficiently large radius, I am confident that that's not true.
Right.
And of course, what I would say then is, but my method of procedure is to build myself models where this uniformity is imposed, compare it to the data, hear the complaints, and say, my God, you know, I've got to this point, these things are all at some sort of clustered in angle, what's going on here, right?
Right.
So it's. I want always to start with what's simple, and look at it and push that on the data, and then I'm not going to be narrow-minded about, I'm going to be interested precisely in these disagreements.
Yeah, sounds sensible.
Yeah, well, we just heard before coffee, right, that there are these stars, they're all going out and not coming in. This is a case of, this will show up as a bad case of bias in the angle variables.
So I find this very, very exciting that it should be possible to identify tidal disrupted clusters and try to determine actually when they were disrupted just by doing this. But I'm wondering how much does that depend on your knowledge of the underlying potential where these clusters are, and so if you don't have a perfect knowledge, will that completely erase the signal or not?
Well, in this paper we investigate a couple of potentials. I've shown you the diagram with the right potential, and then the same exercise is done with the wrong potential, and you don't get such a sharp. So in other words, the name of the game is you tune your potential. You need to repeat this exercise with various potentials, and the good potential is the one that shows up these large excursions.
So it's in a way it's this kind of self-consistent method where once you see a large excursion, you know both that the potential is right and you get the date.
Well, with one cluster you might say, oh, I just chose, you know, I fudged it, etc. But if you found that you were able to bring order to different phenomena, different clusters with one potential, you'd say, my God, that's, you know, this is the potential. So part of our program is to tune the potential until we get things sharply focused in action space, because it's, you know, it's like adaptive optics. You tune your telescope until you get those stars tightly clumped, because you have prior knowledge that they jolly well should be.
Okay.
Yeah, so I have a comment and a question, which the comment partly relates to what Mario was asking and also Catherine, which is that even if you have a time-dependent potential, we looked at this and Facundo presented a poster on this, that the structure still remains and that the separation, this characteristic scale between streams gives you the accretion time. So it's very nice. The question is, what happens if the potential is strongly triaxial? So you have a large amount of chaoticity. Can you still use this method?
Yeah, you can use this. I mean, so Mikko Kasalainen investigated this in two dimensions 10 years ago, and the method works well in the following sense, that you can construct an integrable Hamiltonian. Basically, you force the tori through the chaotic region, and then you have an integrable Hamiltonian, which is very close to the actual Hamiltonian, and the stochasticity can be characterized in perturbation theory. So I would say, this is as much as I know about this problem, right? But I think that that's going to be the right way to handle. I mean, clearly in the galaxy there will be a large chaotic zone around the around kerotation of the bar, and it will be very exciting to bring some order into this. If you just integrate orbits, you just get a stochastic mess. So I'm excited at the prospect of understanding this in a systematic way, in terms of the underlying integrable Hamiltonian. This is the problem with classical perturbation theory. All these people proving theorems and stuff are not doing anything useful because they don't tell you what the nearest, Km and all that, they don't tell you what the nearest or even a near integrable Hamiltonian is. We do.
One more question.
All right, real quick. So that was what you meant by saying that you wanted to...
You're going to include the correct or better perturbation theory using Fokker-Planck. You want to put Arnold diffusion in a Fokker-Planck sense. That was what you're.
Yeah, that's the ambition. Okay. Yes, exactly. That's the program. But I don't know.
But you do need the mathematicians to tell you what the fusion rate actually is, because it's non-uniform and so forth and so on.
Yeah,
so.
My jibe was that they have all this stuff about when the perturbation is epsilon. But if you give me if we just take a generic Hamiltonian, it's not integrable, and I don't know what epsilon is because I don't know where an integrable Hamiltonian is. So their results are not useful. But with this, maybe we can make them useful.
James, a question following up on to Mario's about the ability to reconstruct past events. So he asked about the incomplete knowledge of the potential for all the upcoming surveys. The errors on the observables are actually pretty well known. How much of that fine structure that the plot showed have a chance of surviving? In light of, for Rave, even for Gaia, we know what the error should be.
I think it's okay. Paul, do you have a comment?
In action space in particular, I've looked at this very briefly, and structures do seem to survive remarkably well, though massive health warning on that. This is very early results.
I think another way to put this, Hans Walter, is that people, Clement et al., yourself included, have found such structures by looking at integrals, which are not integrals. I mean, using things like total angular momentum, which are not, nobody thinks are integrals. And by doing that, you can only make the situation worse, right? So if you can find anything you can find doing that, we can find better. I think that's obvious. How much else we can find with data of given quality remains to be seen. I'm hoping to be able to tell you soon.
Okay, so I think it's time for lunch. So let's thank James and all our speakers this morning.
If you had enough streams.